You're listening to Campfire Conversations, brought to you by Three Rivers Land Trust. Connected to the land, committed to conservation.
What's going on, everybody? We are back with Campfire Conversations here with Matthew Williams, yours truly. Got Katie Stovall, our conservation lands manager, joining us today. You want to say hey, Katie?
Hello, everyone.
And then last but not least, Jim Blythe, the Osprey man.
Our special guest for the day. We're super happy to have Jim, a supporter of the Land Trust and a man with many hobbies, but one hobby in particular that's special to us and helped us get a project off the ground, or I guess we helped him get a project off the
that's
ground.
That's right.
So we're excited about that. If you want to introduce yourself, Jim.
Well, you know my name is Jim. Howdy, y'all. And humbled to be a part of Three Rivers Land Trust from the outside, and just tickled to death that they were willing to step in and help me with my passion.
Yeah, we're glad we could come out and help you with it, man. It's not often we get people asking to help us come out and put up an osprey platform, so I think it's definitely a niche that needs to be filled more often. But just kind of a little bit about you, Jim. You know, where you from? You know, how'd you get into doing all the osprey platforms and everything? You know, kind of what started you to go down this road? You know, kind of for me, deer hunting and fishing in general is my hobby, but it sounds like doing the osprey work is your hobby. Or one of them.
And I will say, just to add to that introduction, Jim's unique in that, and I really like Jim because I meet a lot of people, but you rarely meet folks that are as passionate as you are about osprey and birds. And I would say, you have a lot of knowledge in regards to birds, and that's something that we closely align with.
Well, I think the primary thing that Three Rivers does that I love is preserving water qualities. And this is something that the osprey have to have. And the I'll tell you where I'm from. I'm from Charlotte, North Charlotte, Bates Ford Road area. And it was the country back in those days. And so I spent a lot of time in the woods squirrel hunting and quail hunting. And when I was in third grade, they built the Lake Norman Dam, and after that I was a water bug. You know, spent a lot of time in the water. We had the whole lake to ourselves, if you can imagine, up until about the mid-80s when Duke Power started releasing land for development, and things changed rapidly after that. And my dad was a birder of sorts, although he was misinformed about a lot of things, and it made me curious as about birds. And I think the curiosity, when I saw a bird, I wanted to know more about it than, well, there's a gray bird, or there's a black bird, or there's a red bird. Mm-hmm.
Which are things that folks take for granted every single day. You know, there's such a, you can look out your window and see a whole lot of birds, but I don't think your average person can identify a lot of those.
And like when I was getting ready to go to school for wildlife and all, like I just wanted to be somebody that could walk through the woods and know everything that's in it. And that always keeps me gives me the drive to keep learning more and try to learn more things. Because, you know, just for me sitting there in the deer stand, you hear birds going all the time, you know, singing their songs, and just, you know, it's something cool. You got a little app on your phone that can pick up the different bird songs, and it'll tell you what it is.
Yeah.
But, I mean, just being able to hear those things and knowing what's there and knowing what it's doing or why it's doing it is just so cool to me, and, like, always been really important for my drive for wildlife management. But
so, Jim, I'm curious. You said your dad was misinformed about a lot of things bird-wise. What does that mean?
Old wives' tales, and you know the misinformation is not. I mean, it's rampant today, but even back then, he was misinformed about, for example, the loggerheaded shrike, a bird that is deeply endangered, and I've seen I think one in the past 20 years. But they were quite common when I was young. And they have the habit of taking insects and even small rodents and frogs and attaching them to barbed wire and coming back later to eat them.
Huh. Impaling them, essentially.
That's crazy.
And,
you didn't
know that? Yeah.
Are they actually like on the endangered species list or a threatened species?
I think they're a threatened species.
Are they?
Yes.
Okay.
So that would be something if you were ever walking through the woods. So barbed wire is a great place where they do that. But if you know like a honey locust, they're a tree that has a lot of spikes on the stem. And, you know, so traditionally before humans and barbed wire, that was not a thing. And they've adapted to use those. But they would use a lot of those different structures that naturally occurred, whether that was briars or those super sharp things on the stem of a tree like honey locusts. But yeah,
that's insane.
Yeah, they're a cold-blooded killer.
But I mean, that's just crazy how like different animals and everything use the environment around them to their advantage.
Yeah.
For different like hunting habits.
Yeah,
that's awesome though.
So he was misinformed on the loggerhead shrike in particular.
Well, yeah, he that's the one that comes to mind, because I must have been I don't know, 7-8 years old, and he's shooting baby shrikes off of a pine limb where they had nested, and it's a cardinal sin because it's a wonderful, wonderful bird. And they called it a butcher bird.
Yep.
That was the nickname. Now, it's just misinformation. It's just ignorance.
Yeah.
I'd say that's a good name for the bird, though.
I think,
impaling stuff on spikes and all, you know, that's kind of gruesome.
But, you know, if you're not anybody that's trained in ornithology or anything like that, you don't know the difference between that bird and a gray cat bird, right? So, I guess it's somewhat obvious why somebody might do that or just not appreciate the difference in all those birds and how in reality they all fill a particular niche.
I mean, it's just like me when I worked on my butterfly projects and stuff, you know, I didn't really have a deep understanding of how important those insects are to our ecosystem and like how intricate the species are of different butterflies and everything. But like every little requirement they need is so specific.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just made me have a greater, you know, understanding and respect for that species, because before, you know, I just see butterfly, okay, it's just another flying insect that I'm about to kill, you know.
Yeah.
But now it's like I'll take time to stop and look at them, look at all the different cryptic patterns on their wings, and stop and actually take pictures of them. Because if you actually get into looking at like all the differences in butterflies and things, and I'm sure birds are the same exact way, you know, it's just so much more than just what meets the eye, I think.
I love that you say that, though, because I think, talking about your dad, because I think about, this example stands out to me. I remember I was young, and I asked my dad, I said, Dad, where do turkeys sleep? And my dad is a different breed, so to fully, I guess, understand and appreciate what I'm going to say, you have to know him. But, you know, I'm a little kid that doesn't know much, and I want to know everything I can, and I look up at my dad, and I said, Dad, where do turkeys sleep? And he looks down at me and said, where do you think, Katie, they sleep on the ground, you know? And it's just, it's easy to get where a lot of these wives' tales or misinformation comes from, because if you're not trained in it, it's kind of a...
But, you know, the internet brings a lot of bad things in the world today, but, you know, the amount of information that's out there now is just at the tip of your fingers.
Right.
Like, I mean, just like with the apps, you know, there's Plan ID apps that we use all the time, or I use all the time, but there's no reason for nobody to not know something anymore. You know, it's just whether or not you have the desire to learn that, you know. And I think some people may just not care, but, you know, I think it's people like Jim to come out and like do things like with the Osprey platforms, you know, because, you know, we were just talking about a little while ago, you know, why do you put it in this exact place, or why do you put it over here versus over here, or why do you use this type of post, you know, like what I was asking you about using the cedar pole and all, and we can talk about that a little more about the design of it in a minute. But, you know, just knowing all of that stuff is just a wealth of knowledge that needs to be passed on to other people, because without it being passed on or passing on that passion, you know it's going to be lost.
Yeah.
Like, I was messing with my squirrel dogs the other day with my neighbor, and, you know, the guy walked over there with her, and he was like, you know, they never really want to go in the woods and everything and all this stuff. And I go over there with the dog and let them start playing with a squirrel tail on a fishing rod, and they're having a ball. And
like, the kids or adults?
The kids were. Okay. The dad was, too. Like, he never messed with squirrel dogs or anything before either. And, like, you know, eventually I turned the dog loose so she could go do her thing or whatever. But then the little girl was asking her, she's like, can I go follow the dog? Can I go follow the dog? And I'm like, dude, that's awesome. You know, like, that's a kid that, you know, may have never got to experience that. But now they're, like, wanting to go run through the woods. Yep. And the dad told me, he was like, dude, I've never heard them before say, I want to go walk in the woods.
Yeah.
Which is insane to me, because, I mean, I grew up in the woods pretty much, you know, and I'm sure you did too. And Jim, you know, you just said that. But I just think so many kids today will never have that opportunity if they're not showed it by somebody. So, like, all these guys that say, you know, be a mentor to a younger person is very, very important. But anyway, sorry about the rant. But.
Well, no, that's well said. If a child has an inquisitive nature, it usually goes on into their adulthood, and that's what it's all about, being inquisitive and wanting to learn is so important.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's really cool. You know, we get some of these kids to some of the programs we do, like mm-hmm. we've been doing recently. I think it's a good way to, you know, just outreach to that younger generation, because I remember when I wrote my, you know, proposal letter for admissions to NC State, like, I wanted to conserve wildlife and wildlife habitats to make sure it's passed on to that next generation.
If somebody doesn't do it, it gets lost.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't imagine what my life would not be what it is today without my dad taking me hunting or fishing every Saturday and just giving me the drive and dream to make sure somebody else has the same opportunity.
Yeah.
But,
all right, I'm going to turn Matt's microphone off now. And
all right,
we'll continue with Jim's story of how he got involved in the birds. Just kidding, but go ahead.
I just was always inquisitive about birds and learned little by little. I'm nothing like the professional birders that. Are you familiar with the annual competition up in southern New Jersey during migration?
I didn't
time.
Know that was a thing.
Mm-hmm. Hundreds and hundreds of birders show up from all over the country, and they have competition to see who can identify the highest number of birds.
Is it like natural, like outside, or is it just bird calls that they're playing, or sight? Like, how does that work? Do you know?
Oh, they all just are out on their own. And, of course, a bird song is as good as an as seeing the bird. You don't have to actually see the bird. I'm opposed to that. You know, I think it's during their migratory season, and they drop off at this area on a point in southern New Jersey before they fly across on down across the Chesapeake Bay and further south. To me, it's too disruptive to the migratory birds to have hundreds of people converging on the area at one time, but that's just my opinion. I think my music background has led me to be pretty proficient in identifying birds with their calls. A lot of birders are just visual, but it helps to be able to identify birds by their calls. My first proactive thing that I did was starting to build bluebird boxes back in the 80s. And I got to know a professor at Davidson College, Mr. Standback, biology professor. He's retired now. Still in contact with him after all these years. He and the college, Davidson College, have put up hundreds of bluebird boxes on the greenways and golf courses in North Mecklenburg County. And recently, he has shifted from helping the bluebird. Now, bluebirds have recovered famously. They, this is going to get long if I keep going on about the bluebird, but they were greatly reduced in number because of loss of nesting sites.
Yeah.
Farmers always, and back in the day, used wooden post and barbed wire, and now they use metal post and no barbed wire, and that's hurt the shrike as well. But it was an initiative, human initiative, that brought the bluebird back. And so he started experimenting on trying to refurbish the brown-headed nuthatch numbers and the gray gnatcatcher numbers by installing bluebird boxes with smaller holes. And the smaller hole, one-inch hole, a bluebird can't enter. And that's been reasonably successful. And the tree swallow has struggled due to lack of nesting sites. And they nest in cavities. The bird species that nest in cavities, particularly the woodpeckers, are struggling in a lot of ways because of the introduction of the starling, which I've seen a flicker woodpecker, northern flicker, spend weeks knocking out a hole on a dead sycamore tree in Albemarle. I was working on a bridge project there, and as soon as he got a decent hole knocked out to start nesting, starlings moved in. And house sparrows nest in cavities as well.
I think that's something important that a lot of folks don't realize either is, you know, they think a bird box is going to work for every species, but every single bird or group of birds have a different nesting preference. You know, some birds are going to build your traditional nest in a tree branch, but there are many birds that's not going to do that. They're going to build a nest in tall grass, you know, versus some that's going to, like a woodpecker, going to build their own cavity. So that's something to think about. If you're interested in birds, it's not a one-size-fits-all thing.
Hmm. Well, he knew that the tree swallow loved streamside nest sites, so he put up, and the college put up probably 50 boxes along the Outlet Creek at Lake Howell, and the tree swallows have come in numbers, and it's been a huge success. And that got me into, you know, Lake Howell is a beautiful place. It's well protected by the Water and Sewer Authority of Cabarrus County. No fishing allowed, no boating, pristine water and fish qualities. And it needs a half a dozen osprey nesting platforms.
Well, it has one now.
Right now there are two, one at the north end and one at the south end. Thanks to your help for the one at the south end. They don't know who put up the one at the north end, but it has to be cleaned out every couple of years because it's not a good design, but at least it's functional.
So I got kind of a quick question, and I've heard you say it a couple times. Why is water quality so important to the osprey?
They have to have healthy fish populations, and without water quality, and you know, there can be fish in there that are tainted.
Mm-hmm.
Lake Norman, I'm a little worried about. The North Carolina Wildlife Federation, along with the Lake Norman conservationists, installed an osprey nesting platform on the entire Catawba River chain. But right now, there are certain areas of Lake Norman where they say you should not swim in it.
Really?
And that's concerning.
Mm-hmm.
And it, I mean, it's important to the osprey too. So for somebody listening that's never seen one or know what they saw, if they saw an osprey, if you're ever over a river or lake and there is a bird flying over top of it, there's a good chance that it could be an osprey. And osprey are pretty unique in that they feed almost exclusively on fish. So that's what they're doing. If you see them over a lake, you know, they're likely looking for a meal, and they'll dive down and grasp a fish in its talons, and they're excellent fishermen, I guess you could say.
You know, we were talking about it after we left putting up the Osprey platform. You were telling me about, like, the eyes and how they can see so much better than, like, humans. You said they have, like, what's a little I don't even know what it's called, but maybe Jim knows. But you said they had, like, little lenses they put over their eyes or something.
Yeah, I was pretty sure I was messing with you for that one.
Well, I wouldn't have known any difference.
But they all, I mean, they truly have excellent vision, and that's why they are effective hunters, because they can see a lot better than we can as humans.
Well, since we're on osprey trivia.
Here we go.
Their eyes automatically adjust to the refraction that the water causes, where they have to adjust when they dive down, and they dive down feet first with their claws, and they can see well down into the water. They can fly over any body of water and tell right away whether it's sufficient fish populations there for them.
Huh. So they basically have kind of like polarized sunglasses on, in a sense.
It is. And
that's crazy.
their nostrils shut when they go into the water automatically. They're one of six land species, that occur on every continent except Antarctica.
It's wild.
That is cool.
Hey guys, we're going to take a quick break from the show to talk about one of our sponsors, Backcountry and Beyond. You can visit Backcountry and Beyond at 322 South Main Street in Salisbury, North Carolina. So be sure to pop on down there and get all of your outdoor needs, or if you can't make it down to Salisbury, you can shop online at www.backcountryandbeyond.com. The team at Montgomery Community College in Troy invite you to get to know their forestry management technology program. For decades, MCC has been helping forestry students explore this exciting, high-demand career option. MCC is located on the edge of the Uwari National Forest in the Uwari Mountains. The campus is situated on approximately 150 acres of timberland that is managed by the college's forestry program. Forestry is considered one of MCC's specialty programs, with other options including gunsmithing, hunting and shooting sports management, taxidermy, and pottery. Visit montgomery.edu to see course descriptions and explore the exciting world of forestry for yourself.
So they were endangered by DDT back in the 50s and 60s, but they're making a comeback quite well. And as Katie said, they're very specific on where they can nest. They can't just build a nest in any tree. It has to be the highest point around, hopefully an open area. And they mate for life, and the male builds the nest, and they come back to the same nest year after year. They nest one time a year. They lay usually three eggs, and the fledglings take 54 to 57 days to actually be able to leave the nest and fly away. So they only fledge one time a year, or only nest one time a year.
And that, you know, that's really why it's so important, or a reason that these nesting platforms can be beneficial, because if you're thinking about traditionally, you know, especially Lake Norman, just like you talked earlier, that's a great example. You think what areas used to look like versus what they look like now. You know, now a lot of these recreational lakes, they have houses all around them, whereas if it's a river or a lake, either one, traditionally they may have had trees and a standing dead snag there that could be a great spot for an osprey to nest. But you know, now with development and houses getting stacked in all these areas, and folks mowing their yard and keeping out every little bit of vegetation they can, a lot of these traditional areas that osprey could have used have been lost.
That's true. What really got me pumped up about it is I saw the struggles of the osprey behind my house at Lake Fisher, and Lake Fisher is managed by the City of Concord. It's a municipal lake, and no development around it to speak of right now. But the water quality has been maintained. The fish populations have been maintained. They do allow boat rentals, John boat rentals, for fishing. And I fished there in the late 80s and early 90s. My church choir director lived in Kannapolis, and I lived in Davidson. He'd bring me up here and fish. But in 2014 was the first year that I saw a pair of osprey at Lake Fisher. And they were nesting in the top of a cell phone tower behind a Baptist church. May have been the first year they tried to nest there. The male got hung up in some cables and hung upside down up there and starved to death. I couldn't get any help to try to retrieve the bird, to help the bird. But the female found another mate, came back to the same nest the next year, and have been up there every year. Now, I don't know how successful they've been, but if they return, it's usually been a fair amount of success. But it's 200 feet up in the air.
And it shows you too that if these birds do not have quality nesting areas, they're going to look for something else to nest, right? Because to survive, they have to nest. So if you're driving along, if you're on a boat on the lake, and you know, just like you're saying, a power pole, cell phone tower, anything, if they don't have a good place to nest, they might nest in those other areas that might not yield as good of nest success.
And it's, you know, I've been on the lake fishing too, around some of those osprey platforms and all. I think a lot of times they put up signs that say, you know, stay back so many feet to not disturb them, especially when they're nesting, which is, you know, after learning a little more about it, about, you know, I used to think, you know, I mean, what's the big deal? It's a telephone pole in the middle of the lake, you know, the birds are going to nest up there. But like after learning all this and like how important it is to not disturb them during that time, like, it seems very, very important. So, if you've ever been like me and think that, you know, definitely change your way of thinking. But, so I'm just kind of curious, you know, obviously we come out and help set the pole and put the platform up, and we can talk about the specific details of what we did. But I just kind of, let's go through kind of a step-by-step everything you've went through to get this one platform put up, and just kind of talk about all the little details of that. I think that would be really cool.
Because it's not like you show up to Lowe's Hardware and be like, all right, let me get an osprey nest platform, yeah, please. It's a involved process that takes a lot of man hours and a lot of planning and a lot of doing to get it where it needs to be.
Well, almost exactly a year ago, the osprey had a nest at the old ballpark at the north end of Lake Fisher. And a nest was built on top of one of the light poles at the ballpark. And it was about 2 years old. And they are tolerant of people. I mean, mm-hmm. Can you imagine mm-hmm. they're having ball games, they're having fireworks, and they're still nesting because where else are they going to nest? The trees are not suitable around there. There's no high spots to place these huge stick nests at Lake Fisher. None.
And that's something to think about too. These osprey aren't nesting in a small little traditional nest that you think about. These are some big old nests that they keep adding sticks to year after year, and they can get, I don't know how many pounds they can get to, but they can be pretty massive and pretty impressive.
But they sold the land, the property, I mean, I think it was City of Kannapolis and Rowan County, they sold that land, and the contractors tore down, you know, demolished the ball field and the nest. So I was hoping very much to get a platform installed on Lake Fisher to replace that particular, just my hope last year was have one up by springtime so that same couple would return and find another place close by. But it didn't happen because Lake Fisher we had a tremendous amount of rain last winter, fall and winter, and the lake was really, really full, and there's no places to put in a post. But getting back to your question, cedar is, in my opinion, the best material to use if you're trying to come up with an osprey nesting platform.
Mm-hmm.
Post. I didn't have access and don't have access to any utility poles, which would be ideal, but they're tremendously heavy to deal with and to install. And I talked with the people at the Baptist church where the cell phone tower is, and I'd seen some straight, tall cedar trees in there, and all the hardwoods had grown up around the cedar. So the cedar was barely hanging on to life.
Right.
And the only place they had any real greenery was way up at the top, and almost no limbs on the straight part, mm-hmm. and straight as an arrow. You saw the post.
Yeah, it was a good one.
So little by little, I went in there and picked them out. I tagged them last fall, thinking mm-hmm. that I'd be, you know, but not until a couple months ago, I finally got in there and cut them down and drug them out of the woods. And two of them I was able to throw in my truck. And
yeah, I remember you sent me a picture of them.
Hanging way off the back of my truck. And was able to locate two of them there at Lake Fisher. And Katie and Matt and Three Rivers, the other one was a larger pole, and they were able to transport it down I-85 to Lake Howell, where we installed that one.
Yeah, so we have a 28-foot trailer. And to set the stage for this, we, as you can imagine, a post that large is not light. So we brought the tractor with us, so that way we had a little extra push to help get this pole set up.
A little oomph.
Yeah, a little oomph. So we loaded this pole up on the trailer, but obviously we had the tractor and the bush hog, so it was a little bit of a thread the needle scenario to get the pole on the trailer with the tractor and the bush hog.
Would you like me to describe the scene?
I mean, if you want to, but I probably won't go into too many details about it.
We'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, but I mean,
we got it done though. That's the main thing.
It was strap safe. You know, me being the safety nut I am, I had like six straps. About two.
She wasn't going nowhere.
About two straps in. Matt's like, "Oh, it's perfect." I'm like, "No, we ain't trusting this. I'm gonna go ahead and just add a few."
It'd be bad to shish kebab a 18-wheeler going down the road, wouldn't it?
That's exactly right.
But so, all right, the materials, you know, using a cedar pole is the best thing because it's natural, you know.
Will not rot and insect right. resistant.
And then, you know, a utility pole, that'd be great. But sometimes they can be hard to come by. And like you said, they are cumbersome. But I think you said on another one you were using some 4x4 posts just because I think you said that's all you could get, right, for those projects, the extra ones you got to do.
I'm using cedar posts for both of those.
Oh, okay.
And if you want to get to the platform itself,
mm-hmm.
All the material is available at Lowe's. It's a 4x4 chain link gate fence, and with struts that come down and attach in four locations to the post. Now the struts are round, and you have to mash the end, flatten the end down and bend it. We won't get into details there, but Lake Norman conservationists were kind enough to give me some leftover pieces that they had that had been flattened on the end in a machine shop.
But and you did say, though, that there is a way to do it without that machine. You get out there with an old sledgehammer and pound it down.
That's right. The first ones I beat on with a sledgehammer.
That takes some doing there.
And we're going to use that one at Lake Fisher, but it, you know, it. I needed an anvil, which I do not have an anvil.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's going to work.
I mean, I do it a lot of times too. You don't always have exactly what you need, but you care enough about it to make sure that you get what you need to do done, no matter what it takes. I mean, that shows dedication.
I think that's what's cool about these particular nesting platforms too. Like, don't get me wrong, it's a very involved process and it takes a lot of work. But at the end of the day, for materials, like Jim said, you can go and get most of what you need at a local hardware store or your backyard mm-hmm. for the post. So if you're passionate about it, buddy, you can do it, you know.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You're not, it's not nothing that's, you know, you have to spend 14 weeks in a design process. You know, there's mm-hmm. there's diagrams out there of the best management strategies to do this, and you can get it done fairly easy.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a North Carolina Wildlife Federation design.
Yeah.
Now, I added a perch to mine because I think the male needs a perch to defend the nest from predators, mainly crows. And on YouTube, they have all kinds of osprey nesting platform designs, and most of them are treated lumber.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as simplicity and drainage, I just like this design, the North Carolina Wildlife Federation design. Drainage is everything.
Yeah.
It's got to drain.
And that's why this nesting platform was better than the original one on Lake Howell, because it is essentially maintenance-free. And I don't know if you want to talk about that. The other one on the other end of the lake requires maintenance of somebody going out there and making sure that it is drained or whatever it needs, so that way the osprey continue to use that area.
That's right. It's a round, circular, heavy-duty plastic bowl.
Mm-hmm.
With holes in it for drainage, but after a couple of cycles, those holes plug, and as soon as the water starts, it starts holding water, and grass, weeds start growing out of it, they won't nest in it.
Right.
It's too soggy.
Yeah.
And the Water and Sewer Authority cleaned it out last winter, and 1st of April, a pair was back in there with a brand new nest. So
that's
that
awesome.
That was delightful.
Yeah.
But I told them, you know, I'll provide a North Carolina Wildlife Federation design if they want to swap it out, and you don't have to worry about maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
So, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, that's why, again, this design works so well. Like you're saying, the bottom of it is chain link, so there's nothing there to catch water. The osprey, Jim put some sticks on it originally to give it a little more appeal.
That's what I was going to ask. Like, what was your, like, reasoning again behind all that of why it's, you went ahead and attached, I think you attached them with zip ties, didn't you? Or something like that?
I used some tie wire. It's called seeding the platform.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just more attractive to the birds if they see some sticks on it.
Okay.
According to
yeah. But you think
what I've read.
You think about this particular design, it's chain link on the bottom. It has those sticks on there that were placed ahead of time to make it more attractive. And then the osprey are going to continue to add more sticks over time. But because it's not a bowl, it's not one contiguous, you know, flat surface, there's nothing there to catch and hold water. So when it rains, that water is going to permeate through, not hold water, and hopefully be even more appealing to the osprey over time without, you know, us as humans having to go up there and do something else every year or every 2 to 3 years.
Yeah, and all the components that we used are galvanized.
Mm-hmm.
So very resistant to deterioration and rust over time.
So what goes into the placement, like the location? What is like the ideal place to put a osprey platform? I think you were saying, you know, some are over water, some you can do over land. Can you talk just a little bit about, you know, what's the ideal placement of a platform?
The only stipulation is away from a lot of taller trees around it, and near a source of good fish populations. And at Lake Howell, I wanted to put it down in that flat bottom over closer to the water, but they wouldn't allow it. So
mm-hmm.
they had to specifically mark out the spot that where we put it down. I'm satisfied with
mm-hmm.
it. It's a little closer to the woods than I like, but
I know I've seen some in lakes in the actual water body, and then some, you know, like we did the other day, are up on land. Is there one better than the other? Is it, you know, better to have it coming straight up out of the water if possible?
That's a good question. I'd probably no advantage there. It's just, they fly miles
mm-hmm.
for fish sometime. And, you know, the access to fish is a little easier for them if they're right there at the water.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't mind. They're hardworking birds.
And I think that'd be another advantage to, or at least an advantage of having a pole like that actually in the water, is you're reducing the predation. You know,
mm-hmm.
if something can't get out there in the water, that's just one additional thing that could negatively impact.
Which is really important, too, about the construction of the pole. We did put a predator guard on there, which was, you know, basically just probably about 24-inch piece wide sheet metal.
Aluminum flashing.
Mm-hmm.
raccoons can be a problem, and they will swim out to a platform and climb up. But
pesky rascals.
They can't climb any.
Ricky.
No climber is going to be able to get above the aluminum flashing. Their claws just won't grip.
Talking about raccoons, I was talking to my dad on the phone the other day. I drove past a raccoon on the side of the road, and I was like, "Oh, Ricky's sitting out here on the side of the road." He's like, "What are you talking about?" I'm like, "You ain't ever heard that? Ricky, trash panda, bandit, raccoon."
The old raccoon.
But I think it is important to note on that, though. Raccoons are, you know, a nest predator that people try to, you know, I guess do a little bit of trapping with and trying to control their populations, because not as people hunt raccoons as much as they used to, and they don't have a main natural predator to kind of control them either. So, but I know a lot of people usually focus on that when they're trying to improve nesting birds, whether it be ground nesting birds or something like ospreys as well. But
I think another important part of the whole equation, which we don't really need to dive into, but there's a lot that goes into putting up the platforms, the poles, all of the above, you know, the actual manual labor of it. But there's a lot that goes on in addition to that, because as you can imagine, you can't just walk out on a lake and be like, "All right, I'm gonna put this pole here." You know, you have to, there has to be a lot of cooperation that goes on between the actual owners of the lake and, you know, somebody such as Jim and ourselves who put it up. And we don't have to get into it, but it's just something else to think about of, you know, it takes a lot of work.
I think you said you had, what, like a year of time going, trying to get permission?
It's been the most difficult thing that I've tackled since I retired. And it's not the physical part of it.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
The red tape.
Yep. Yep, for sure.
I mean, we had, what, maybe 4 or 5 hours of actually putting the platform up.
Yeah.
So that was the easy part.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
But, so... is there anything other major about Osprey platforms? We got a few more minutes we can talk about them. And
well, once you, you've seen a lot of them out there, and you've seen what works for the birds. They like an open area and the top of whatever they're nesting on. We've got a bald eagle that's been nesting up at Davidson Lake, and he's right inside of a pine tree. You know, there's an opening, and they built their nest right in the pine tree, which they're an aggressive enough bird that raccoons, they can fend off a raccoon.
Mm-hmm.
You said that
you had seen a nest one time. It was a... the male stays with the nest to, you know, protect the female while she's sitting on her eggs. And you said you've seen, like, the male just have to stay there and fight off, like, birds dive bombing the nest before, haven't you?
The only thing that I've seen was from the Osprey webcam at a platform at Lake Norman. And they didn't put perches on any of their platforms. Don't know that it would have helped in this case, but crows ganged up and took over the nest, and he tried his best. They both tried to fend the crows off, but it was a losing battle.
Uh-huh.
So crows are a problem.
And that's something that's wild to me, and you can see that with crows and hawks and all of the above, but, you know, an osprey is bigger than a crow. And osprey have sharp talons, sharp beaks, all of the above, and it's just wild. It's like the crows are the middle school bullies, you know. They're always terrorizing other birds, but it makes you wonder. It's like, you know, why is this going on? Because, you know, I feel like if you were to put osprey and a crow in a wrestling ring, that osprey would intuitively come out on top. But nonetheless, they, like you're saying, they are a nuisance to osprey as they're nesting, and many other birds as well.
Well, the crows... like to gang up, you know.
Yeah, strength in numbers.
Exactly. Strength in numbers, and they work on as a team, and you know, you get a half a dozen of them take over a nest, and two of them get to eat the babies. You know, it's
a tough world out there.
Survival of the fittest.
Yeah, for sure.
But as far as educational, you know, these webcams are, I would want my grandson and granddaughter looking at a live Osprey webcam. And they've got them down in Florida. You can pull them up on YouTube. Another thing that you might find interesting, they are migratory birds. They leave when it starts, you know, when all the other migratory birds head south. And they go to Florida, Gulf Coast, and all the way down into South America. But they do not reproduce, even though they're going to a warm climate in Mexico, South America, they do not reproduce down there.
Mm-hmm.
They reproduce when they fly back north. And they reproduce all the way well up into Canada. And so they migrate quite a distance. You will find them in the wintertime on the intercoastal waterway, sometimes as far north as Charleston in the winter.
Yeah.
But they're not reproducing at that time. Those particular birds will fly to Canada.
Even further.
To reproduce.
Sure. Cool deal. So I think it was a great project, something that would not have got off the ground without somebody that was interested, inspired, and had the determination to make it happen like Jim. So, you know, I think that should be inspiration to anybody listening. Of a lot of these projects don't get off the ground unless there's somebody that's passionate enough to make it happen. So I think that's kind of the call to action to anybody. And, you know, if there's any way that we at Three Rivers can help, we're happy to.
We want you to be dedicated.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But I just want to say personally, Jim, thank you so much for letting us be a part of this project. I mean, just after working with you and talking with you, you know, I feel so much more knowledgeable about the Osprey and, you know, how important it is to our ecosystem and, you know, just all the little things about it that make it special. Just kind of, it's my new butterfly that I can have something to, you know, respect a little bit more when I'm out there on the lake and I see them fly over and just think about, hey, I helped that bird out a little bit by getting to work with Jim on putting up that Osprey platform. But, Jim, you got any closing remarks?
Well, I just hope you and Katie will be curious enough to ride out to Lake Howell next spring, early April, maybe.
Absolutely.
You know.
That'd be cool.
And, of course, the other one is visible at the north end of the lake at the headwaters, which is a beautiful headwaters with lots of waterfowl there, egrets and herons and the platform is right there off of Highway 3. The city of Kannapolis has a pump station there,
mm-hmm.
and the city of Concord's pump station is up by the dam where we put the other one. But if you ever want to ride down Highway 3 there, you can view that round bowl platform as well.
Yeah. And if you're on the other end, look over your shoulder and you see that that pole out there, well, yours truly. Mr. Jim helped us get that done and installed. So,
well, I just want to say thank you everybody for listening and being a part of this conversation with us, and hopefully you'll come back for more and we'll have more exciting things to talk about.
Until next time.
Thank you.
So long.
If you like the show and would like the episodes to keep coming, you should know that our podcast is just one of the tools that we use at Three Rivers Land Trust to further our conservation mission. Our number one priority and purpose is to conserve land and natural resources for future generations and to be a voice for wildlife and to ensure wildlife populations have habitat forever here in North Carolina. This podcast is just a byproduct to further that mission. You can visit our website at trlt.org to join us in this conservation mission.